The following podcast contains explicit language.
Hello, and welcome to the Bad Romance edition of Slate Money, your guide to the business and finance news of the week. And I can tell you that in recent weeks, it has sometimes, especially over the summer, been quite hard to come up with a bunch of recent financial news of the week. And also because there's been this presidential election going on, and that's kind of drowned out everything else. But this week has been completely insane, and we could have 7 shows with what on earth has been going on this week. So we're just going to more or less pick at random. But I just want to give you a taste, because I think this is indicative of something, and maybe we can talk about what, just in the past week, in terms of mergers, we had GE looks like it's going to buy Baker Hughes for about $30 billion. We had BAT, that's British American Tobacco, it wants to buy like the bit of Reynolds, which is an American tobacco company that it doesn't already own, for $47 billion. There's a telco merger, Level 3 and CenturyLink merging. That's going to create like a $30 billion company. There's a brokerage merger. We had TD Ameritrade agree to buy Scottrade. That was just $4 billion. That's absolutely nothing. There's a massive semiconductor merger where Qualcomm, the semiconductor giant, is buying this company called, I have to admit, NXP Semiconductors, which I had never heard of, but which apparently makes computer chips for cars and is paying $39 billion for this company I'd never heard of. And so, yeah, love is in the air.
Or bad love.
Or bad love. This, by the way, is Mr. Edmund Lee.
Hello.
You run a website called Recode.
I am the managing editor of Recode, yes.
And Recode is an awesome website, so go check it out. Edmund Lee is here stepping in for Jordan Weissman, who's on an airplane. Kathy O'Neill is also here.
Hello, everyone.
She is an expert in bad romance. We have a little bit of bad romance as well.
That's looks, my middle name, baby.
We were expecting, were we not, Ed, the announced merger of Gannett and Tronc.
Goodness. Ugh.
That one didn't happen.
Nobody even knows what those are. That sounds like made-up words.
Well, I mean, that's, you know, what the newspaper industry has come to, right? Which is, you know, a once-storied big newspaper company that a lot of journalists now don't like working for because of all the cuts. This is, I'm talking about Gannett. And Tribune, which I guess they've decided to call this bizarre. I don't even want to say it. But anyway, you know, Tribune, LA Times, Chicago Tribune, like these are big major news outlets, and you know, some still functioning more or less, the fact that they can't even make this happen is just, it's crazy.
But clearly, if you're in any industry other than the completely terminally doomed newspaper industry, now is the time to get it on. There seems to be, I mean, just from what I was rattling off there, hundreds of billions of dollars worth of financing available, like at the push of a button or something.
Well, with basically near zero interest rates, right? Money is cheap. And so you're gonna get these deals done before December when the Fed decides, hey, guess what? Maybe we should, you know, bring that back up.
So we are going to talk about a merger which we haven't even mentioned yet. We are going to talk about the sort of mergery thing that it looks, at least like on a trade deal, Canada is going to merge with Europe. I kind of like this.
Exciting.
It's called CETA.
It's the CETA. Yes.
And we're going to talk, because Ed is here and he's, you know, at Recode and he knows everything, we're going to talk to him about what happens to tech companies when they go public. There's been a bunch of news around there. We had a little...
Or when they die.
We had the death of a minor social network this week as well. It's been a busy week. But, Ed, what is the number one biggest, most important merger that everyone has been obsessed with all week?
Oh, my goodness. Something involving a little-known telephone company, or very well-known telephone company, AT&T, looking to buy Time Warner, Time Warner Inc. Now, let's be very clear about that.
Because the Senate managed to get this wrong.
Oh, absolutely. So, and you know what? I don't blame anyone if they're still confused by this, because it's not necessarily intuitive or easy. But basically, Time Warner Inc. is the media company that owns HBO, CNN, Turner Networks, the Warner Brothers movie studio. it does not own, that means it does not include Time Warner Cable.
And it also does not include Time.
Time, exactly, which is the foundation of this media empire from you know, many, many decades ago. So it doesn't include Time. And
there are exactly three public companies with the word Time in their name, only one of which owns Time magazine.
So I'm going to jump in here because I've been kind of stalking Ed this week on Twitter.
I'm used to it.
Because I'm just like, who cares about all these mergers? Like, do they make any sense to the average person whatsoever? And I've decided to like glom onto this issue of names.
Yes.
Time,
yes.
Warner. Because, like, correct me if I'm wrong, but didn't Time Warner and Time Warner Cable just simply split in like 2009? And if they're splitting back then, why are they merging now? Like, what changed?
This is my favorite question, and this is literally the number one question which people should be asking about this merger, is that Jeff Bukas, who's the CEO of Time Warner, famously spun off Time Warner Cable as a separate company because he's like, content and distribution are two entirely different businesses. Let's spin them off. And if you value them separately, they'll be worth more apart than they would be together.
So that same dude.
And then that same dude is now saying content and distribution belong together in a beautiful vertical stack. What we want to do is merge Time Warner with AT&T, which is the distribution. Now, I'm going to come out and say that for all that this doesn't make any sense on its face, I kind of think it makes sense. I can come up with a reason for why it makes sense. But Ed, does it make sense to you?
I think it makes very, very little sense.
Oh, good.
There's a whole lot of reasons here. But I think to go back to Felix's earlier point and your point as well about why would you want to then merge with a distribution company when you spun off one before? So Bukas actually had an answer for a bunch of reporters when he was asked this. His answer was interesting and not entirely believable or one that I can latch onto, which is this, is that when we spun off Time Warner Cable, that was a regional distribution player, meaning has a regional footprint. It sells to customers in New York City and LA and other parts around the country. And, you know, it was smaller. AT&T is a national distribution company. So my sort of counter to that is that what difference does that make to your content, right? Whether you – and this is – I'm getting to the heart of why I don't think this deal makes sense. No matter how widely distributed or not widely distributed content is, you still make content. In fact, you want to distribute it as widely as possible. So being part of a distribution company doesn't change or should not change your content calculus.
Okay. So here's my next question, and it's directly related to this, okay? Can you give me one example – of a really good merger that happened in spaces like analogous to this, where you're just like, that makes sense and it works, not just for the, obviously for the CEOs who always get paid out a lot of money, right? And maybe for the shareholders who enjoy things like this too, but makes sense as a business. Like it makes other people happy. Like one example of a merger where the public is like, holy crap, this is great.
Yeah, I can't think of one. I mean, you have to understand that the motivation for lots of mergers, I mean, it's very – sometimes it's very balance sheet focused. They thought
right.
The word that you know, companies use is synergy. What that really means is how many costs can we cut, right?
I'll give you an example.
I'd like to hear the okay. – right.
I have a theory too, but okay, Felix first.
Okay, so here's a good example of a merge which I think was really good for both companies was Google buying YouTube. Like YouTube on its own could not have had nearly the same amount of success that that it had as part of Google. Or for that matter, you know, since Ed is in the room, we can say that when Vox Media bought the Curb Network, that was really good for the Curb Network. And it's been good for Vox Media as well. So there are horizontal mergers, which makes sense. This is not a horizontal. This is a vertical merger.
So you're talking about buying up like basically competitors.
Was Google competing with YouTube?
It's a good question.
Well, Google didn't have – I mean, I think it's a good point. So I think a few things. Yes, we're very happy to be part of the Vox family, and I think that's a fair point. I do think there are definitely sort of mergers in sort of smaller spaces, smaller industries that maybe don't immediately impact consumers. I think that sort of goes to the heart of your question. In this case, we're talking about vertical versus horizontal. So what these basically mean is in the case of AT&T, they are buying Time Warner, which is a vertical merger, which is to say – AT&T and Time Warner don't compete with each other. So what does that mean for the consumer? The amount of choices you had in wireless carriers and cable companies does not change. In other words, they're not reducing competition out of them.
This is not an anti-competitive merger.
Right. Well, so here's one thing that might change, right? And I know that this may or may not change, and I want your opinions on it. But I know for a long time the data people of the world have been really excited about the idea of tailored television ads. And I feel like this, in some sense, presents that opportunity, but at the same time, it might not be allowed to happen.
And this is where I want to jump in and say, you know, we're talking about AT&T as a television distribution, as a national television distribution giant, which it is, but only really because it just spent $50 billion buying this company called DirecTV. What AT&T really is a mobile phone company. And while everyone knows that at some point in the future, we're all going to be watching a lot of television on our mobile phones, right now, no one's watching television on their mobile phones. It's just not something we really do a lot of.
And it's a weird prospect, right? Like, do you really want to do that? Is that really why you want to spend $85 billion so that you can get people to watch stuff on your phones? From the AT&T's perspective, you know, for mobile carriers out there, the mobile market is saturated, which is to say everyone who wants a mobile phone already has one, meaning you're already paying someone for service. In order for AT&T to grow or Verizon to grow or T-Mobile, they're just fighting for share. The way they're fighting for share is through price wars, right? So it's getting harder for even big, massive companies like AT&T to grow their business. So what are they doing? Oh, let's buy a content company because we think that's the future. If we can differentiate our service by having something that the other carriers don't have, then maybe we can charge more. Maybe we can have stickier customers.
I'm not 100% convinced about this idea that what this means is that AT&T is going to zero rate HBO and you get free HBO on your AT&T
cell phone. I don't think that's going to happen. That's exactly right. That's not going to happen.
I think there is a reason for this. And this is the reason why, as I say, I think it makes sense for a distribution company to buy a content company, even if it doesn't make sense for a content company to own a distribution company.
Because?
Okay. Is that... If you're a distribution company, you have two choices. One is that you are a dumb pipe and everyone just buys content directly from Netflix or whoever over the top. And you just sit there saying, I'll charge you $40 a month for internet and that's all you're ever going to get. The second one is that you bundle things together. And historically, this is what cable companies have always done, is they've made a huge amount of money by bundling television channels together and then selling them for like $100 a month. And the problem with the bundling model is that there's a handful of content companies who have an enormous amount of negotiating power. You have basically the five big networks, ABC, NBC, CBS, Fox, and Univision, who have to be on that bundle. And then a handful of brand name cable channels,
ESPN,
CNN, HBO. So what and when you're negotiating as a cable company with those channels, they have all of the cards because no one's going to want cable TV from someone who doesn't have ESPN. So you basically have to pay ESPN whatever they're asking for.
And also take these other channels that maybe you don't want.
And then ESPN is owned by Disney and they're like, you need Disney Family Channel 8 or something. And you're like, no, I don't. But you're going to wind up paying for it anyway because you need
ESPN. Okay, I'm going to channel my children here. None of us are that young. So I'm going to channel the young people of the world. And the young people of the world are so uninterested in any of this stuff. And I want to – can we talk about that?
Let's talk about the latest announcement from DirecTV.
The $35 a month thing.
So DirecTV Now, which is their over-the-top or streaming TV service. Basically, you can buy your TV. It goes over the internet. You can just sort of call it up on your Roku device or your smart TV device or whatever it might be. And that's, I think, the direction all TV is headed in. I think – so – but to your argument about why this might make sense for a distributor to own a content company – The sort of counter to that, however, is that Time Warner, which owns HBO, CNN, and all these big, important, essential channels, they can't not sell that stuff to other competing
distributors. But this is exactly what I'm saying, is that you have this – it's a natural hedge, basically, that if you own a distribution company and you are getting gouged by Time Warner because they're charging so much for CNN,
you get
you're
to,
like, hey – It's just I'm paying it from one hand to the other hand.
So, and you know, if it's a, so you want to diversify your business, fine. I think and, if that's the argument, like, I'll buy
one
that.
One other really, really big part of this, which I think people haven't been putting enough weight in, is that AT&T, for all that it is a really massive company, is basically entirely an American company. Time Warner is global. And if you're looking for growth, the growth is going to be global. It's not going to be in the U.S.
Meaning, so Time Warner selling HBO to, like, Latin America and Europe and Asia and
content
other parts.
Right. They have Warner Brothers. You know, they have Superman. Right. Superman is a global franchise. It makes more money abroad than
so
it does in
do we
the US.
Think young people are interested now? We're talking about, like, Superman and...
Yeah, right. Yeah, I do. Okay. I do, but I do think that, like, the... I mean, here's my theory about it, and I might be totally wrong. You guys know more about this than I do, but I've been at a company that was acquired by another company, and I was like, they probably paid too much for this company, and by the way, they have a pattern of buying stuff every couple years, and I feel like that is also a thing where people are like, you know, if you merge or if you acquire... People don't really understand how to evaluate you as a company. But if you keep doing it, like, it sort of postpones that evaluation. And I'm wondering, like, they're buying DirecTV. Now they're buying all this. I mean, are they sort of just continuing to grow because they don't want to sit still and be evaluated?
Well, they're continuing. That's part of it. But also, they're continuing to buy things because they're having a hard time growing otherwise, right?
Yeah.
As I was saying earlier about the sort of the price wars and sort of it's a saturated market and they're just sort of fighting for share now. In order for them to sort of grow outside the bound, and you're right, AT&T is basically an American company. It's like, that's it. Like, you know, everyone who wants cell phone service already has one. So how else am I going to grow? When they bought DirecTV, that was what they're basically buying were TV contracts, right? The licensing rights that DirecTV already brokered with Time Warner and Fox and you know, all the other content distributors.
So it brings up the question, like, are they paying the right amount?
And the fact is, like, in terms of how much they're paying, they, you know, AT&T is a big, boring utility company, which I believe has raised its dividend every year for 25 years.
And you can't not pay the dividend. It's called, you know, retiree stocks, basically. It's like if you're a...
It's in a category.
Yeah. You have to pay that dividend because that's what people rely on.
And they care about that. So what they're not doing is buying Netflix. Right, because Netflix, they would have to spend probably $75 billion if they wanted to buy Netflix, and Netflix basically doesn't make any money, and so then they'd be like, how on earth do we get to keep on?
That's the other thing; they'd be taking that much more debt, right? So AT&T is borrowing a lot of money to buy Time Warner,
but Time Warner is cash flow positive, right. So they can afford to do that and still keep on paying.
If you want to sort of wonk out on the math, some of this, it's like, I think AT&T CEO Randall Stephenson sort of marked it as their debt load after the deal would be something like 2.5 times EBITDA profit, right? And he said that's an investment grade. I mean, it's kind of – he said we're going to bring it down to 1.8 times EBITDA profit by this time next year and it'll be fine. Don't worry about it. Everyone's concerned about the debt load that AT&T will take on to buy this and also to do their dividend and everything. So if you're worried about the numbers on that, there's a rationale at least that they've come up with on the balance sheet.
And then like, you know, if you just do it on a basic like multiple of Netflix level, I think it's pretty obvious that you'd rather have Time Warner for $85 billion than Netflix with its market cap of $55 billion. You know, I think I would probably rather have HBO alone than Netflix, let alone everything else.
I disagree.
Rather have Netflix because...
Because remember that Netflix has to pay for all of its content. It doesn't really...
It's so much better. For the young people are so much more into it. Like, and the young people are our future.
There is actually another argument in Netflix's favor in terms of the business strategy, which is this, is that the content that's on Netflix, and Netflix is increasingly just... It's originals they're owning, meaning they own it outright and they can do whatever they want with it. That's exclusive to Netflix. And Netflix, and you can argue, is also its own little distribution channel. Yep. As opposed to, say, HBO, for example, which has to sell to Verizon, Fios, as well as to Comcast, as well as to every other distributor. So AT&T, who now owns or will own HBO, doesn't have an advantage by owning it, right? Because all their distribution competitors will also have to, you know, have that available to them. Whereas Netflix, however, the content they own is exclusive to Netflix.
Yep.
Not anywhere, you know, you're not seeing that on, you know, it's not the most parallel argument, but like people are paying for Netflix. They're not paying through Verizon or other distributors like Comcast or whatever.
Okay. So, I mean, we've already gone way over time on this segment,
but that's
okay.
Yeah.
I do want to just finish with the stock market crazy here. The value of this deal, the value of AT&T shares is a little bit, up and down, but it's in the region of $105 to $107 per Time Warner share. Since the deal has been done, there's been like $12 billion of turnover in Time Warner shares. Lots of people are selling Time Warner shares into the market, and the price they're selling them for is like $87, $88. They're accepting $20 less per Time Warner share when they know that if they just hold on to their shares and the deal gets done, they're going to get $20 more. Ed, why would anyone sell their Time Warner shares at such a big discount?
So we're now getting into the risk arbitrage sort of area where...
Well, a little bit, but yeah.
A little bit. So basically, typically when an M&A deal is announced, the company that's going to be acquired, their stock shoots up, but not quite to the level that the acquiring company sort of is offering, right? So if you're offering 107, you're not going to buy it at 107. You're going to trade it around maybe 100, maybe 95 or something, because there's always a chance maybe the deal doesn't entirely go through. The gulf between where Time Warner is currently trading versus what AT&T has offered is a lot, in my opinion. That's telling us the stock market does not think this deal will pass because regulators, DC, DOJ, FTC, maybe even the FCC will jump in and review this and say yes or no to allow this to go through. It's leaning towards a no if you look at precedent, there's no reason this deal shouldn't go through.
Because Comcast bought NBC.
It's a similar type of deal. It's a vertical deal, right? But there is, I think, a sort of a growing faction in D.C. that wants to create a new doctrine or a new measure or a new standard for antitrust things, which is size. In other words, you're just too big. I don't care. It's vertical versus horizontal. We're not going to let that happen. We think it's bad for consumers. Now, that's frankly kind of an amateur read on the situation because, as we said earlier, as a consumer, your choices aren't changing, right? You still have to pay AT&T a lot of money. It's going to happen regardless, right? So anyway, I think it's politics now potentially playing into it, and I think that's what the market's reacting to.
Your pet is one of a kind, and so is their journey. While every playful moment is a memory in the making, sometimes cats and dogs are a little too good at getting into trouble. That's why you should check out ASPCA Pet Health Insurance. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program offers customizable accident and illness plans, making it easier for pet parents like you to help your pet get the care they may need. The ASPCA Pet Health Insurance Program has been around for over 18 years, and they've helped more than 600,000 pets during that time. They allow you to customize your plan, helping ensure your pet's plan is as unique as they are. Because vet bills can really add up, especially when you're least expecting it. It's simple. Use their app to submit a claim and you'll receive reimbursement for eligible vet bills directly into your bank account. To explore coverage, visit aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. That's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. Again, that's aspcapetinsurance.com/slatemoney. This is a paid advertisement. Insurance is underwritten by either Independence American Insurance Company or United States Fire Insurance Company and produced by PTZ Insurance Agency Limited. The ASPCA is not an insurer and is not engaged in the business of insurance.
So this is the perfect segue to my next segment, which is this wonderful thing called CETA, where Canada and Europe are merging. You thought AT&T and Time Warner was a big deal.
No, this is far bigger.
This is far bigger.
Canada has gotten sick of us and said, like, once and for all, we're leaving.
I mean, they've kind of always been a little bit more European anyway, right?
That's true. Yeah.
There's this thing called CETA, which you think would stand for the Canada-Europe Trade Agreement, but in fact it doesn't.
You know what? I thought that's actually a good way to sort of break that. Yeah, that's a better acronym, right? Then what is it? Comprehensive
Economic and Trade Agreement,
which just sort of sounds like almost a global thing, right?
Yeah.
It's like it could be any country around the world, like where it's comprehensive, right?
But no, it's a purely Canadian European thing, and it's eliminating 98% of tariffs between Canada and Europe. And it is also getting rid of a whole bunch of like occupational licensing restrictions so that if you're an accountant in Romania and you want to move to Vancouver and practice as an accountant, you can just do that. You don't need to pass new exams and that kind of thing. They have been negotiating this for seven years,
yeah.
And they finally managed to get it together. And Justin Trudeau is going to land in Brussels on Thursday and sign an agreement. Ed, why did he not do that?
Why didn't he just get it done? Well, I think they're done with this deal now, right?
They are done with the deal. There hasn't been the great prime ministerial signing, though, because this is where we all get to talk about, for about 3 or 4 minutes, we get to talk about Walloons. And how much fun is it to talk about Walloons?
So Walloons are what? They're French-speaking Belgians?
Yes.
You know, we love Belgians in our house because they eat even more frites than Dutch people. But I guess, you know, when you think about like standard economic theory and why trade is good, we always assume that tariffs are bad. But I think the truth is like they're actually really good for some people, right? They're protecting some people and some people's industries.
The poor Wallonian farmers.
Yeah. So like what's going on there?
I don't think it's the poor Wallonian farmers.
Oh, you don't?
No. Okay. But let's give a little bit of
background. The Wallonians in the first place, right? Like why are they a factor at all in this? Why were they a factor?
Okay.
Right?
Exactly. Why were the Wallonians a factor? The answer is because one of the reasons this trade deal took 7 years to negotiate, which frankly is quite not that long. By trade
deal. For such a big deal like this,
but
yes.
By trade deal standards, trade deals always take years and years to negotiate, which is one reason why you can't negotiate Brexit in 2 years, but that's a whole other subject. The deal needed to be ratified by all 28 countries, all 27 European countries and Canada, and they all signed off on it. They said, yes, 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 yes. Belgium is, I'm going to come out and say this, not really a country. It has no reason to exist. It makes no conceptual sense. It's basically a random bit called Flanders, which should really be part of Holland, and a random bit called Wallonia, which should really be part of France, and a city called Brussels. And because Belgium is not really a country, and it has literally gone for years without a government.
Yeah.
And it's quite good.
Well functioning.
It functions and it can go for years without a government. But one of the effects of this is that all of the power is in the regional governments rather than in the national government, because there is no national government because it's not really a nation. And so one region of Belgium, Wallonia, just stood up and said, "Tch," in a kind of French way, as the French did, they go, "Tch." And yeah, we do not like this free trade. And they
decided to
veto it. And because this one stupid Belgian region wanted to veto it, the whole thing was off. And the Canadian trade minister, who Ed and I know very well.
Of course.
Chrystia Freeland.
Weekly talks, right?
But she used to be my boss.
Journalist, right?
She came out and was pretty much in tears. And she's like, "I'm flying back to Canada. I can't even with these Walloons."
But wait a second. I mean, they had some real points.
Mostly
right?
What their points were like sort of pan-European leftist talking points of, we don't like these trade agreements. They're going to allow Canada to import genetically modified food into Belgium and this
so
kind
I mean
of stuff.
That was the like sort of ideological opposition, right? But in actuality, I think a big part of the populace there. I mean, it's the equivalent of like the Rust Belt region in the U.S., right? It's an industrial manufacturing base, and the economy there has been terrible for a while. And I think they're suffering the effects of, you know, which now has become a bad word, globalization, right? Which is, you know, going back to free trade, and more free trade is better for everybody. And they're, you know, they haven't sort of evolved. And this is a lot of first world economies, including the U.S., were going through this growing pain of transitioning from an industrial base to a services and tech economy base, right? And I think certain regions are sort of left behind or left farther behind. It's taking longer for them to catch up. And I think that's what they're reacting to as much as, I mean, sort of in a sort of very sort of visceral way, right?
I'm just going to like throw in my theory about this, right? Now, free trade, in theory, improves countries overall, all the countries that involve it. But it doesn't improve every individual's life. And the point is that like because of what you said about Belgium, it becomes more closer and closer to the individual vote. And there was like a region where just like we haven't seen improvement because of these treaties and we're going to vote against this and we're going to stall this. And that's why that's why these trade agreements don't go through when like small enough groups of people get to
And also just because they're French and the French people are obstructionists and they love to say
okay, but
no.
I'm just going to jump in though. But one of the things they actually push through, it seems, is a sort of appeal system to this sort of ISDS stuff that we talked about a couple of weeks
ago. So we had a whole episode on investor-state dispute settlements because that's how exciting.
Who gets to sue whom and how.
Slate money is.
Yes, so they have a way to appeal a ruling from the ISDS court, like going to the European Union something.
Yeah.
That's actually kind of exciting.
And eventually, it has to be said, the Belgian prime minister, who does exist, thankfully, because there have been times when there hasn't been one, but there is a Belgian prime minister, and he managed to twist the Wallonian arms enough that the Walloons gave up. And so now we are going to have a comprehensive economic and trade agreement.
And do we think that somehow, in a weird way, like Canada is essentially replacing the UK in this, that's my read on it in a sort of backhanded way.
I wanted to provoke Felix into talking about what this means for Brexit. Poke him with a stick.
Well, I mean, so very briefly, what it means is the same thing I've been saying all along, that Brexit is impossible. That in order for Britain to negotiate Brexit, it's going to need to get unanimity from all 27 European countries. And if you thought that was possible before, which pretty much no one did, you're not going to believe that's possible now. Does anyone believe that Belgium and Greece and Portugal and Romania are all going to say, okay, yeah, that deal sounds good to us, we'll just sign it within 2 years? Like, it's inconceivable.
Also, TIPP looks like it's threatened, which is the European-American treaty that's been long negotiated, and Obama has, like, given up on it, I think.
And TPP, which is the Pacific one, that one looks like it's not going to happen either. So much for treaties. Bad year for trade deals. Oh, and whatever happened to Doha? Do you remember that? The Doha round of the World Trade Organization? This has been going on for, I don't know, I want to say like 15 years now, and has gone absolutely nowhere.
This podcast is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you're driving, cooking, or doing laundry, Progressive knows the podcasts you listen to go best when they're bundled with another activity, much like how their Progressive home and auto policies go best when they're bundled. Having these two policies together makes taking care of your insurance easier and could help you save, too. Customers who save by switching their home and car insurance to Progressive save nearly $800 on average. That's a whole lot of savings and protection for your favorite podcast listening activities, like going on a road trip, cooking dinner, and even hitting the gym. Yep, your home and your car are even easier to protect when you bundle your insurance together. Find your perfect combo. Get a home and car insurance quote at Progressive.com today. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. National average 12-month savings of $793 by new customers surveyed who saved with Progressive between June 2021 and May 2022. Potential savings will vary.
Okay, enough trade agreements. Let's talk about stock market companies, the news which we kind of hinted at earlier, which is there's this struggling social network called Twitter, which owned an even more struggling social network called Vine.
I talked to the guy who was supposed to be in charge of dealing with abuse on Twitter.
But let's...
Oh, my goodness. Yeah, that has got to be the worst job in the world.
But in any case, Twitter went public with great fanfare. And because it was a tech company, everyone expected it to grow like gangbusters, because that's apparently what tech companies are meant to do. And then it didn't grow like gangbusters. And so everyone in the stock market who paid vast amounts of money for their Twitter shares are saying, boo hiss, we hate you, you've got to change what you're doing, even though really it's just doing what it's been doing all along, and there's a finite number of people who want to use that service. And one of the casualties of this is Vine, which is sad because there are some wonderful Vines out there.
Well, in fact, yesterday when it was announced that they're killing off Vine, I think Vine was the number one trending topic on Twitter.
It was.
I think my entire feed was just like, oh, here's the best Vine. Yeah. Oh, no, this is the best Vine. And please sit down and watch this Vine.
I saw some good Vines yesterday.
Oh, my God.
I saw so many good Vines. Interestingly, the place where I saw most of the best Vines yesterday was this other like hot kind of social network called Slack. Like, the entire Fusion Slack was, like, just taken over by amazing Vines.
I have a question about this, which I'm going to address to you, Ed.
Sure.
I was reading this thing on Vox this morning, written by Matthew Iglesias, about the idea that, like, Amazon will not be consistently profitable anytime soon, and it's by choice, and how Bezos is basically like, if we made ourselves consistently profitable, we'd have the wrong kind of investor interested in Amazon. And it just made me, is that a thing to have you're like, as a company, you're like, I'm going to attract a certain kind of investor? And if it is a thing, how did Twitter go wrong? Because I feel like Twitter.
So there's always. Yeah, that's a great question. So in terms of specifically Amazon, that has been Bezos's operating mode really since the beginning. There's nothing really new going on
and
with Amazon.
And he famously wrote this in his initial shareholder letter when they went public in 1997.
Yeah. Don't buy into my company if you're looking for
big profits.
I want
everyone to write that letter.
Well, so his job, in his mind, his job is to make Amazon as big as he can possibly make it. So in that endeavor, that means spending to either buy things or build things or get into new areas or new regions like India, which is what he's really trying. It's all these things are expensive, or spending money on content for Amazon Prime, all things expensive. So that's been his operating mode. That's his thesis. If you want to buy into his company, that's what you have to agree to. Some quarters might have profit. Some quarters might not have profit. I've never seen a public company like this where when they give forecasts, estimates for what the next quarter might look like, sometimes the profit range they give is actually we could lose $100 million or make $100 million.
Yeah.
Like he will actually give forecasts like that and you're like, what the hell? You're not investing in Amazon for the profit margin. You're investing
in
Amazon for the growth.
AT&T.
Exactly.
Yeah.
In the case of Twitter. And so that's always a long-running tension between for public companies between the people who run them and the people who invest in them, right? And so it's as much of the CEO saying to investors, look, this is what we're about. Don't buy on X, Y, and Z numbers that you're seeing. Don't believe the traders. Don't believe all the sort of the talking heads you're seeing on finance networks talking about why this is good, why this is bad. I'm telling you what you're investing in. Twitter, and this is true of a lot of Silicon Valley companies, has not done a good job of giving its message to Wall Street.
Well,
here's
what we're
about. So this is what you have to buy into.
I mean, like, to be Amazon, it's not enough to just not make money. You also need to have.
I can do that.
You also need to have a CEO who knows what he's doing. Like, Jeff Bezos is, you know, genuinely a good CEO.
A visionary. Yeah.
And famously, Twitter has just run through CEO after CEO, none of whom seem to be particularly good at being CEOs.
I'm going to defend the CEOs of Twitter. Like, Twitter's great idea was Twitter, and then they stopped having great ideas. Like, can we just enjoy what it
well,
is?
Well, but I think that goes back to the point you were making. So Twitter has about sort of the metric everyone looks at with Twitter for investors or anyone who's interested in the business of it, monthly active users. How many people are on actively using it? It's about 317 million now. This most recent quarter they reported, the quarter prior, something like 313, 312 million. In other words, it's really not growing. It's an esoteric service, meaning it's really just
a mere 300 million people use it.
Globally, right?
Still,
if you think about the size
of people.
It is, but compare that to Facebook, which continues to grow. It's amazing.
And there's a whole bunch of social networks which are younger than Twitter and bigger than Twitter, including, we have to talk about this, Snapchat, which is going to go public and apparently, according to the news this week, is looking to raise $4 billion.
And that's a massive amount for an IPO, for a raise. When a company goes to IPO, they're just, you know, we're going to sell some shares and make some money and that'll sit in our treasury and we'll use that for stuff. But that implies a larger value for the entire company. Raising that much money, though, from the IPO, what is it?
Why do they need $4 billion?
Yeah, what are they going to do with $4 billion?
That's the problem. I don't know. It's a privately held company. They can do whatever they want.
They're
right now.
They're going to buy Netflix.
But I think, you know, the allure of Snapchat, or they've renamed their company Snap Inc., but the service itself is still called Snapchat. The allure is that it's lots of young people, right? And if you're an advertiser, that's your biggest conundrum right now. Where are the young people? What are they doing? How do I reach them? Oh, this Snapchat is where I'm supposed to be. So let's go do that, right? And so they – shiny new object. They spend a lot of money on there. I think it's working. I don't know. They keep telling me a lot of millennials are looking at my product as a result of this. So I'll spend more money. And I think that's the promise. So that's their interest. In terms of Wall Street, however, it's just sort of like we want something that's not Twitter, please.
Could it be Snapchat? And there's enough people on Wall Street that they have $4 billion between them and they're willing to buy $4 billion of shares, even though they know that like 6 months later, a bunch of lockups are going to expire and there's going to be a bunch of other Snapchat shareholders trying to sell them. Anyway, we will talk about Snapchat IPO when we get to Snapchat IPO. I just want to talk, I mean, since we're talking about these like amazing, charismatic CEO, tech CEOs like Jeff Bezos, I should mention, just because it was a big surprise to me and I think to most other people, Tesla made a profit this quarter. Tesla is one of those companies which is never meant to make a profit, and it made a profit.
Elon Musk somehow came
out with a profit, and the stock was like, oh my God, are you kidding me? You're like, you're still like 3 years away from being like a real big car company, and you've already made a profit.
No, they blew away expectations, and I have to say, I was surprised too. I mean, like, unlike software, unlike tech companies, like, building a car, right? Building thousands of cars, it's super hard. You know, it's, there's so many moving pieces, quite literally, and you know, you can't always control them. And I'm not saying building code or building software isn't hard. That's incredibly hard, and those are hard things to estimate, but there's less friction, right? There's less, you know, sort of—
It scales more easily.
Scales more easily, exactly. You just build, you kind of build it once, and you just, everyone taps into it. So I think, I'm completely surprised. I think Elon Musk, you know, he's clearly got things up his sleeve. I think it's hard to count him out. Like Jeff Bezos, I don't know that he quite rises to the level of Jeff Bezos, but certainly very interesting. But going back to Twitter for a second, I mean, the other problem, we haven't mentioned his name, Jack Dorsey, who's the CEO of
Twitter. Oh, yeah, I remember him.
Yeah, exactly. I think part of the issue, frankly, is, or a big part of the issue, is that he has a second job. You know that, right?
Yeah.
He's CEO of another startup called Square, right? Or public
just
company,
went,
right?
Just went public. Had its IPO.
It's a payments processing and payments, you know, it does payments for small businesses and all kinds of businesses, take credit cards, that kind of thing. And I don't know. You can't, I'm sorry, two public companies, no one's that smart. I'm sorry. It's just not.
Well, Elon Musk was the CEO of two different public companies.
Well, and one of them is doing terribly, by the way.
When
right?
It's getting bought by the other one.
Right. So he decided, let's just, you know.
He had this company called SolarCity, which is now being bought by Tesla. And the shareholder signed off on it.
But the thing is, between Twitter and this other company, Square, there's absolutely no reason for them to be under one roof anyway. Yeah. So even that idea doesn't make any sense.
But what's become reasonably obvious is that the Twitter board has now more or less arrived in the what you might call Jeff Bezos land and saying, well, if you write us a big enough check, we will sell. Like, if there's some company, whether it's Google or Facebook or Apple or Reuters or Disney or Salesforce or anyone who wants to spend like $40 billion on Twitter, we are for sale.
A lot of people have thought about it and then said no.
Yeah, because they looked at the company. You take a second look, you're like, oh, wow, this is not a really well-run company. I don't really get this product.
Is it because it's not because of the advertising problems, or is it because of the
abuse problems?
I think
it's because it's too expensive. I think at the right price, you know, there's a bunch of people who would be interested. But for $40 billion or whatever you'd need to pay to persuade the board to sell, no one's interested in spending that much.
And it's for a tech company that, you know, still relatively young, it's not really growing by leaps and bounds. It's like, what am I really buying? You're sort of leveled off. All right, fine. So there's a smallish network that I can own for a little bit.
I feel like I'm the only one who loves Twitter, and I'll wait for the price to get low enough for me to buy it.
You're surrounded by journalists. Like, the one group of people who love Twitter more than anyone else is
journalists. Did you see the idea of like a bunch of journalists getting together and buying Twitter?
Let's save this, please.
I've got $10 in my pocket.
No, I personally love Twitter. I'm on all the time. I think, you know, for Recode also specifically, like, a lot of our audience comes, you know, traffic comes via Twitter. So we are very pro Twitter in that way, absolutely. Again, but from evaluating it as a business, right? I think there's lots of things that need to be sorted. If it wants to grow, it has to sort of expand its product in a way that it doesn't come across or doesn't operate in such an esoteric way, right? Like, it's really hard. You have to really want Twitter. Once you get it, though, it's you become addicted. But there's a big barrier to like really getting it, really understanding it, and finding ways to sort of like apply yourself, you know, to the service. So I think that's the big challenge for them.
I don't know, man. Snapchat's even harder, and that's
oh my god, yeah, that's
okay. Enough of these tech companies. We have a numbers round, people.
Apple Card is the perfect cash back rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/cardcalculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Kathy, you go first.
Yeah, so $798 million. So we have talked not at all about campaign finance, and there's a reason for that, because it's hard to talk about that without talking about presidential candidates. But I do want to mention that the financial sector has spent a lot of money on the presidential campaigns, $800 million, $798 million, which is up 35% since 2008, and in particular, hedge funds.
Well, 2008 was a weird year to be for the financial industry.
But hedge funds have spent $123 million, which is twice from 2012. So, like, these guys are being serious about the influence that they want to wield.
My number is 11. There is a brewery in Sweden.
Ooh, I'm already thirsty.
St. Eric's. And they're super, you know, artisanal and high-end, and they make expensive beer. And they decided that they wanted something which you were meant to, you know, snack on while drinking their expensive beer. And so they said, let's make potato chips. And so they started making potato chips. And they said, well, since we're all artisanal and high-end, we're going to make artisanal high-end potato chips. They have created a box of potato chips, which they sell for $11.
Wow.
This is an $11 box of potato chips.
How many chips are in it?
Do you want to know how many chips are in it?
I know the answer.
The number... 5.
I thought it was going to be... Oh, my God.
Oh.
$11 for 5 potato chips.
How big are... How thick are they?
The margins on that, then, must be pretty...
I want them to be like potatoes, actual potatoes.
But even then, like, would you pay $11 for 5 potatoes?
I was just buying potatoes the other day, and I couldn't believe how different the weight per, the cost per pound of potatoes are. You could go anywhere from $1 to $6 a pound, but no, I wouldn't.
Depending on the type of potato.
Yeah.
Yes, exactly. Right. So I got a number for you.
What's your number?
And I'll end up giving you two numbers. So I'm going to round it down a little bit, $200. That's how much I pay AT&T every month.
What? Wow.
I have that's just not for me personally. That's my household. That's me, my wife, my daughter, my 11-year-old daughter who has her own phone now. And the reason why I bring that up is going back to AT&T for a second, I'll give you another number. After they buy Time Warner, their debt load is going to be about $200 billion.
Holy
so
crap.
I'm contributing maybe one millionth every month, right, to what they need to pay off that loan.
One billionth every month
is exactly right. So – I think,
don't exaggerate your influence.
But I guess the larger point to that is, you know, we talk about these relative to scale in terms of what – just bring it to a personal level. What I buy in terms of media, my household, AT&T is top of the list in terms of how much money I spend versus what I pay Time Warner Cable, what I pay Netflix, what I pay Hulu, what I pay
– Wait, you pay $200 on AT&T, and that doesn't even include television.
Does not, no. That's how expensive. That's what it sort
I
of should
be. Way more for my phones for my family.
Right. And I think this is true for most households. Yeah. And I think that's the sort of perspective that I think a lot of regulators are considering it. And also in terms of what this merger might mean and just the way the world of media, we're talking about could they bought Netflix, whatever. Netflix gets whatever it is, $11, $12 from me every month, and which is a great, great value if you think about it versus the $200 I spend.
And as we spend more and more of our life on our screens, we are willing to spend $10 on Spotify, $15 on Netflix, $20 on HBO. Like, the amount of money we spend for digital subscriptions is just going up and up. And the present value of all that money is it trillions of dollars. And that's why these mergers are happening.
Right.
Okay. That's it. Thank you for listening to Slate Money this week. It was a good one, mainly because Ed Lee knows what he's talking
Ed's
about.
That's amazing.
Thank
come
you.
I'm good at pretending, so.
Come back anytime. Thank you all for listening to Slate Money. It's always as good as this honest. So subscribe to it by pressing that subscribe button on your phone. Leave us a review on the iTunes store. Email us. The email address is slatemoney@slate.com. And check out all of the other Panoply podcasts at itunes.com/Panoply. The producer today was Vera Lynn Williams. The executive producers are Steve Lichtai and Andy Bowers. And we will talk to you next week on Slate Money.